Hi and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NABTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. One of the benefits of my role is that I get to see a lot of data on how people invest, sort of stocks they hold and how those portfolios change over time. And it's always fascinating. We also get a lot of feedback on what people want to know more about, which areas of investing are of most interest to them. And one of the challenges that's really obvious investors are facing right now is one that's probably familiar to all of you listening. It's called home bias, and it means that Australian investors, like investors all over the world, have a really strong preference for investing in domestic companies. What makes this particularly tricky in Australia is that we have a pretty small market, and it's heavily dominated by a small number of companies and very strong sectors. In this podcast, I'm going to talk to Blair Hannan from BlackRock, one of the largest fund managers in the world, about what the average Australian portfolio looks like and how domestic investors can manage some of the risks inherent in that average portfolio. Blair, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Gemma.
So Blair, before we get started, a little bit about your background. You've primarily worked with direct investors, so people like managing their own portfolios. So you're also very close to the sorts of things that investors currently hold, the sorts of decisions they like to make. Now, with BlackRock, you're also across very large amounts of data about how people invest both domestically and across the world. So can you talk me through what you see as being the primary characteristics of a typical Australian portfolio?
Yeah, look, I think from a data perspective, I think the ASX have probably done the most comprehensive study of investors, and you may have seen this data. They've been doing it for many years. What I think's somewhat surprising is that you'll find that most people who are investing are actually investing on exchange-traded type investments.
Okay.
Now, you probably think that, look, property is probably higher on many people's investment profile, and cash, obviously, as well. But what you'll find is because, especially with property, you're getting, it's a large capital outlay, there's potential gearing involved, it becomes more difficult. Obviously, for self-managed super funds, there's an element of difficulty there as well, that it flows back to exchange-traded type products. So you're talking about, obviously, shares, exchange-traded funds, listed investment companies, real estate property trusts. So there's a range of ways that then investors can then invest on those exchanges. So that's probably where they sort of focus. I think, as you mentioned, home bias is typical. Now, from my background and even through this current role, we do see a huge amount of home bias. And I think the key reason for that is because the people are investing what they're familiar with. And that makes a lot of sense. It does. So they know who the banks are. They know who things like Woolworths are. They can walk into that shop and they can get they can gauge how it's going. So that makes a lot of sense. But as you did say as well, that concentrates investments significantly. So what that does is it gives you, with the ASX in Australia, it's very concentrated. It's a small amount of industries and a small amount of sectors, and we're obviously dominated by the banks, resources, etc. So I think that sort of forms a typical type of Australian investment portfolio from an exchange point of view, and that does create some issues.
So it's a really good point you make, you know, that concentration that people experience. You've talked about the ASX data and they've done plenty of good work on this. And the other one is the ATO's SMSF data. SMSFs are obviously only one structure that people hold their money through, but it's, I think, actually a very good proxy for how people hold their money in general. Property, as you pointed out, is much harder to hold in an SMSF just because it's of the nature of the structure and also the sheer size of property assets in Australia these days. But in an SMSF in Australia now, they hold roughly 25% in cash, which is an enormous amount. Cash and TDs, but effectively deposits with a bank. And then listed assets, as you point out, are at least 40% of the average SMSF portfolio. So that is including ETFs and LICs and REITs and all those sorts of things, but mostly just direct shares, maybe some hybrids as well. So this really strong preference for holding things on an exchange that you can see every day, they're liquid, they're well priced, all that kind of stuff. But 40% of your portfolio is on the Australian Stock Exchange. 25% of it's in an Australian bank, which you probably also invested in on the Australian Stock Exchange. So what's left of your portfolio, and this is averages, right? So the average is there's about sort of 15 to 20% in direct property. That direct property is held, frankly, by a small number of investors, so they skew the data a bit. The rest has to give you all the diversification that you're looking for. So what does that sort of allocation tell you about what people are exposed to?
I think what it does is, and we're going back to this concentration, which is probably going to be a recurring theme in this conversation, but I think what it tells you is that if you are invested predominantly on the ASX and predominantly in shares, there's an inherent lack of diversity there. You can't get away from that because of how this country is. And we've all heard the stats that Australia is sort of 2% of the world market. That is really quite true in terms of we're talking about market capitalization, so how big these companies are. So, you know, what you find is, and this is very typical, is that you'll have a holding in one of, if not nearly all of, the big four banks.
A lot of our investors will have all four.
Certainly. You'll have government floats, that whether they have done good or badly, but CSL, for example, Telstra. You may have got NRMA, which has turned into IAG. You probably have major retailers. You'll have the likes of Woolworths and Wesfarmers. So you've got this direct concentration across a huge, whether it be a personal account, whether it be a super account, it goes the whole way in terms of their portfolios. And I think, look, not to say that it's necessarily a bad thing, but and that diversification and the key reasons why diversification are good isn't understood. But I think that what's happened over time is the way that our market is structured, that franking credits, for example, we know that's a topical point of view at the moment in politics. We found a lot of people want to maximise income. Now, Australia is a very income-focused type of investment. Self-managed super funds are key to that. And there's a way to maximise franking. And unfortunately, the situation is that the banks pay a large amount of dividends. They have high payout ratios. So because of that, the concentration gets even worse. But there's a problem with that. And I'm sure many of your investors would know, things like being focused purely on income can cause a lot of issues. So Telstra, for example, is one that comes to mind. Those invested in that would know that once they did release that they were going to cut their dividend back in August, that we had a pretty bad run. It's been about down about 60%. So that creates inherent risks in the portfolio. So that concentration and lack of diversification can cause pretty significant issues.
So the other question is, there's the risk of what you have in your portfolio, the correlation between those things. And so you've got four banks, you are diversified among banks, but you're not diversified across industries in that situation. So obviously there are many headwinds facing banks in Australia right now. Australia has done pretty well. We've had 25 plus years of uninterrupted economic growth. That's unheard of, right? It's the longest run of economic growth in history, from what I can gather. We beat the Dutch. Something to be proud of. So we've done very well. So being exposed to Australia is not necessarily a bad thing. But the Australian market hasn't done as well as the US, for example, the last few years. Been very, very substantial divergence in their performance. So one of the big risks, I think, for Australian investors is what they're missing out on. So what do you see as the biggest issues about what we don't have?
Look, I think, look, you're so right in terms of because of who Australia is. And look, we do see this idea that if I have 16 or 20 stocks in my portfolio, I'm diversified.
Because I'm
across a range of sectors, but most of those companies are Australian focused. So obviously the banks are very Australian focused, and we had ANZ that tried to go into Asia, didn't work, they come back. You do have some BHP and some Rios that do get some offshore exposure and offshore revenue. CSL does that as well. But still, if the Australian economy was to come under a lot of pressure, that's going to put the whole portfolio under pressure. That's just what's going to occur. So I think it is a difficult question to say, okay, well, how do I get to that diversification level? What do I do about it? But I think that's something that investors need to think about and think about seriously. And we obviously have seen that happening over the last sort of 5 years, when it's become easier to diversify internationally or to diversify into different markets. You touched on in terms of our performance. We know that, for example, the correlation of the S&P 500 to the major index in the United States is now very low to what it historically was. And the reason for that is, and what that actually means is if and you talked about divergence, is the Australian market hasn't really gone very well, but the US market's gone very well because it's exposed to industries that maybe Australia isn't. Obviously tech is the key one that most people know about. So you've got these big tech firms that are very world focused in terms of their reach and where the revenues come from. We don't have a lot of that. So there is something to say that Australian investors are missing out on that.
Yeah. So that idea of new world, high growth, now dominant players, it's kind of hysterical that something, you think of high growth as something quite small, growing rapidly, but these are now enormous and still growing very rapidly, expanding all over the world. We have very few companies that could ever begin to hope to have a profile like that. So Australian investors, from our observation with NabTrade, we do see investors, to your point, starting to look at this kind of stuff. So they're buying ETFs, they're trying to get exposure to international markets, either through diversified products, or they're buying on NabTrade, you can buy US, UK, Germany and Hong Kong. 92% of it is the US. So quite clearly investors know exactly where they think the growth is coming for. Or alternatively, to your point about familiarity with the Australian market, the companies they're familiar with are based in the US.
Yeah.
So you have an Apple in your pocket. You know what these companies are and how they work, and so you have some familiarity with the products and so on. So we see our investors looking offshore, and they are using the listed products that are available to them in order to get there. So what are some of the strategies investors should think about? One of the things that concerns me is it's fabulous that people understand having a fairly concentrated domestic portfolio carries some risk. It's certainly done people, banks have done very well, right? And then they've gotten great yield, as you pointed out, and all of those things, but it won't go on forever. And they have missed out on some growth as a result of that concentration. So problem is, I want to access some of the growth and more interesting opportunities around the world. I plan to solve that problem by using assets that I can buy with my existing portfolio, which is great. How do you suggest they put a strategy around that? Because that's the next step. It's not just as simple as going, I'll just pick a few things and good luck to it.
Yeah, look, strategies look really key, I think. And I think a lot of Australian investors, I think a lot of self-directed investors in general, don't spend enough time thinking about strategy and putting that in place before they start to invest. It's much easier just to do it.
Yes.
And get started.
Pick something and go.
Exactly. And then it becomes a bit of a cycle. Now, I think, look, you talked about clients investing in the US or buying Apple or Google through Alphabet. Or Amazon. Now that's fine. It makes a lot of sense. You're getting access to that tech, but I think it does come with extra risks. It comes with having to open a second account. It may come with some administrative burden by buying in the US. There is some issues with that, and I think ETFs or other listed investment companies that are traded on the ASX do solve some of those problems. They don't solve all those problems, but they solve some of those problems, because the idea is with an ETF, for example, that you're buying a basket of stocks. Or bonds or whatever it may be under the underlying asset class, and you're getting it in one package.
Yeah.
And that's a really good piece of technology, especially for many investors that don't have the time to want to invest directly into stocks or want to do huge amounts of research internationally. Look, we know that there is a lot of information on Australian companies, and the familiarity helps with that. But getting a lot of information on a US company or a German company or whatever it may be is inherently more difficult. That's just what it is by where we are in Australia.
I think the challenge is the research is there, but when you have a market with literally hundreds of high quality tech companies on it, how do you make a decision about which one's the right one for you? So for many investors, when you get started, buying something that's inherently diversified is valuable in itself.
Yeah, look, it is. And we know that these make sense. We've seen them in the flows in terms of where we've gone. We know from an ETF point of view in Australia, we've seen it increase fivefold since 2013. So we're now just under 40 billion. But worldwide, we're near 4.5 trillion in terms of investments into these type of investments in regards to ETFs. And BlackRock have just released a bit of a research piece. We think it can get to 12 trillion by 2023. And we see that as a reason, because this is a really simple and effective way people can diversify. Whether that suits their investment needs is sort of up to them. But that's where we're seeing it going, in terms of here's a way that investors can diversify quickly and easily, especially internationally from an Australian point of view, and do so sitting on their ASX account through NabTrade or through any broker that they decide to go down that path. So that ease is what I think is opening up the doors for a lot of people.
So what I think is most interesting about it, because I actually think most of our investors understand, I want to diversify. I want to get access to high growth opportunities. I'm really comfortable using listed assets to do that, whether they're listed in Australia or we actually find a lot of our investors will buy ETFs out of the US market because there's a much wider range. BlackRock obviously is the largest provider, so you guys might well be across that. One of the things I think is most important for investors to understand is that just because something is diversified doesn't mean it's solving your problem for you. So understand what it is that you're looking for. If you want technology to complement a portfolio in Australia that is extremely light on technology, or probably has none, unless you call Telstra a tech company, then you'll need to think about looking for specific exposure. One piece of data that knocked my socks off the other day was that Asia comprises 2% of MSCI ex-Australia.
Yeah.
So the global index that people buy when they're trying to diversify away from Australia is not diversified to the extent that people would think. If you want to get access to India, for example, you may well find that some of the highest growth economies, not necessarily markets, but economies, are not well represented in that. If you want to get exposure to those sorts of things, you've got to start picking through some of the opportunities that do sit in there. The lovely thing about ETFs now, so you can't find an ETF for anything if you wanted it. Do you want to talk about some of those? If people want to start going, I'm going to be more thoughtful than just buying the MSCI or the S&P 500. I don't need a whole lot of financials or resources because I've already got heaps. I don't want to go and buy those offshore by accident. It's just replicating my existing portfolio in Australia.
I think it's a really good point. And I think it's key. I think with the Australian listed ETFs, it's very easy to get those basic, cost-effective, passive vehicles that we all know, so S&P 500, but you are getting a very broad index there. And that works in a lot of cases. But it works really well, I think, as a core of your portfolio. So, for example, we've got a range of core that is, you know, quite cost-effective, that can form the core, gives you access to 40 countries, over 4,000 stocks, 6,000 bonds. That's your core. Now, if you want to get a little bit more granular in terms of what you want to
get a bit sexy in your portfolio.
The ASX is probably not the best place to do it. There is definitely some sector allocations that you can tilt to. There is some more specific ways you can get access to some of those sexy things, as you mentioned. But without doubt, somewhere like the US or the UK is going to give you much greater exposure to those sort of tilts. For example, BlackRock was just released. We have an existing robotics megatrend ETF in the UK. It's got over $2.5 billion, so that's a way to get access to that sort of that sort of trend. Alternatively, we've just released a robotics and AI one in the US as well. So there is ways you can think, okay, well, that's what I see as the future. And you need to do your own research to figure out what is right for you, how much risk you want to take on, and what fits in your portfolio.
Yeah, don't just buy the fancy name.
Exactly. So do that. Or if you want to get exposure to health, you can do that. You know, and we can do that on the ASX, but if you want to even get more specific in biotech, you can do that via the US or the UK. So when you do open the doors to international markets, you are going really, really broad. ARC has over 800 ETFs.
Right.
That's a significant number. And you can spend all year just looking through that list and figuring out what you want. So I think it comes back to that point I made earlier, is that taking time to step back and say, okay, what do I want my portfolio to look like? What do I see as an investor as the best place to invest? And what ways can I do that? So we're going to give you the tools to do it, but you need to figure out which is the best way that fits your risk profile and strategy.
And what are the components you're looking for? We had an investment strategist on recently, or market strategist more to the point, and he was making the point that now, you know, there's a lot of geopolitical risk and now very real economic risks with tariffs coming in and all these sorts of things. And his advice as to portfolio construction was look to fill the gaps in your portfolio. So look where you've got overexposure, look where you're not exposed at all, and try to find the things that will cover you in the event of either a cataclysm or, you know, some expansive growth. Who knows what's going to happen, right? But I thought it was a really interesting point, and I think it's very exciting for investors to understand you can actually access so many extraordinary things now that you would never have contemplated previously. One of them, so his point was he was actually increasing his exposure to gold, which is not something I hear from people very often, haven't heard for the last 15 years, I don't think. So he was increasing his exposure to gold. You can use listed securities to do that now. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and this is the thing. It really, you can pick whatever you want to be exposed to. I think sometimes too much choice is a problem.
Yes, that is true.
Things like Netflix, you know, when there's too much, you just sort of sit there and you just become numb and you don't know where to start.
Do channel surfing.
Exactly.
Portfolio so, equivalent of channel surfing.
Exactly right. So I think that's why, again, stepping back and saying, what does my portfolio look like now? What do I want it to look like?
Mm.
Does that suit my risk? Which again, I don't think a lot of self-managed super funds or self-directed investors take the time to do. And then once I'm comfortable with whatever I want it to look like, okay, now I'm going to go out and find what to invest in.
Mm.
So I can look at ETFs, I can look at individual stocks on any, you know, on multiple exchanges. I can look at active funds, you know, whether it be off market, unlisted ones, or on market. So you've got this huge breadth of opportunity to do that. Mm. But I think it's really easy just to start picking in pieces, and then, oh, this is what my portfolio looks like.
Mm.
Is that what you want it to look like?
Yeah.
Possibly not.
I think to the point you're making as well, investors have been very clearly skewed in their portfolio allocation for a long, long time from a sector perspective. It hasn't hurt them badly. I think only the last year or two would make people sit up and think twice about how their portfolios have been allocated, and then look into the future going, oh, is this really what I want? But we don't anticipate Australian investors going, right, that's it, I'm selling all my financials,
yeah,
and I'm selling all my resources, and I'm going to suddenly find this perfect, sort of theoretically beautiful, diversified portfolio and going with it. Changing your investment strategy, it takes time. You've got to kind of work it through. What are your suggestions about how people start the process? So the strategic work is done. I know I've got challenges here and opportunities here. I want more exposure to the opportunities and less exposure to the challenges. How do you get going with that?
Look, I think the point you make there is really key. It's a process. There's no one day where you go, okay, well, this is day zero. And tomorrow's day one and I've got to start again. I think having that plan in place is what's going to be the key to doing that. And look, there is definitely tools out there that can help you with that. Technology is a really key part of that.
Mm.
There's tools online that can sort of help you look at your portfolio and go, well, does it need a health check, whether that's the right word to use or not, but gives you an idea of where to start. It's obviously, as we talked about before, huge amounts of research that you can delve into and figure out. I don't think there's any one right way to start. I think it's just recognizing the fact that this potentially is an issue in my portfolio. I'm overexposed to banks. I do love the income. It's great.
Mm.
But, you know, there is other opportunities out there. And look, you're right. You say that, you know, they've done very well investing in Australian equities. We have. There's no question. But I think a key reason why most people haven't broadened their exposure is up until sort of 4 or 5 years ago, we didn't have a lot of easy ways to do that.
Mm.
So sure, you had international accounts and you could do it, but it was difficult.
Mm.
So things like ETFs or listed investment companies that give you in one trade access to a wide range of securities, that is that's a trigger. People think, wow, I can actually do this quickly and easily.
Mm.
I can manage this in one place. Whether that be an online broker or a full service broker or with a financial advisor, I can manage it in one place now.
Mm.
I can understand how my performance is. And by being able to do that, that helps with that strategy and saying, okay, well, now I'm out of whack.
Mm.
Now I need to go and change. Now I've done my research and I say, okay, well, I think I need to get exposure to US tech, for example, as we spoke of before. And the way that I can do that is once I get to a point where I feel like there's an opportunity for me to shift the portfolio over. I can sell some things down. I can add some cash. I can take some of the dividends I may have got and move them into some new opportunities. So, you know, I don't think there's any magic pill that just solves this problem.
Yeah, just fixes it.
Because someone will be selling it and they'd be making a lot of money out of it.
Mm.
I think it's over time and it might take a couple of years, but as long as that plan's in place, that's the intention, I think people will get there.
One thing that's awesome for a self-managed super fund, and I speak with a slight guilty conscience because mine's not as good as it should be, is you do have an investment strategy. You have a documented investment strategy. We have to write down what you're planning to do with your money. And there's probably value in SMSF investors thinking about these issues around sector allocation and geographic allocation, not just Australian equities and international equities, but how well diversified am I really? Is this the kind of exposure I want? And you can document that. And then you are beholden to actually doing it at some point. Right at the end of the year, your auditor will say to you, your allocation is miles from what you said it was going to be. You should do something about that. So if you do have a self-managed super fund, you could absolutely think about having a serious conversation with your fellow trustees about what you want your investment strategy to look like, documenting it, and then actually enforcing that discipline of getting there over time rather than intuitively knowing you've got some challenges but not necessarily doing anything about it.
I think that is something that's in place, and we know that's the law.
Mm.
Do people do it well, as you said? Probably not.
Mm.
I think it's a difficult task, sitting down and saying, this is what I want my portfolio to look like and this is what I want to do. It takes time. But if you own a self-managed super fund, that's the path you've decided to go down.
Mm.
That is that's what you take. That's the burden you've taken.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what you've done. So you really need to, you know, we know why people go down the self-managed super fund path. We know that is, they don't necessarily want to pay high fees. They want to have more control. We know these things, but with that comes a process that spending time looking at the portfolio, understanding what diversification means, understanding your options, and setting a plan in place, and then following that plan, I think is what key you know, to what a self-managed super fund needs to do. Because if you're giving your money to someone else, they're going to do that for you. If you're going to do it yourself, you've got to take that on yourself.
It's on your head. Blair, any thoughts about where investors can go to find out more about that? Because you guys produce buckloads of information on this kind of stuff. Where can investors go to find out more about that?
Look, obviously, ETF or any product-wise, BlackRock's got a huge wealth of information around what we do. And there's a range of, I know NAB does this as well. You produce podcasts, which is great,
mm-hmm.
Videos, and that's across the board. Now, I think the opportunities out there, can be too much. You can watch a million videos. You can watch,
give yourself a headache. Yep.
Exactly. Mm. I think there's no one right area, but you know, maybe just speaking to a trusted advisor or speaking to someone who's done this before in terms of how do they structure their plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's an opportunity for any self-managed super funds, even for personal investors. I think this makes sense for both, not just super funds, but everyone who's investing.
Yeah.
Even those who are young, you know, who want to get started, you know, ETFs may be a great place just to kickstart that sort of process. And then once you get down that track, you can start to build a plan out.
Mm.
So I think the opportunity is there to, you know, whether it be via BlackRock, through iShares, or any other type of opportunity out there with any other provider or via shares, platforms like NAB provide you a huge wealth of tools, as do providers like BlackRock. And I think if you spend some time on those relative sites, I think you do well.
Awesome. Blair, thanks so much for joining me.
No worries, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining me.